Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Trinitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program, Young Women with Breast Cancer, Treatment-Specific Choices, Fertility, and Careers. Now, this is a very important program that we're offering today, and I'm delighted with all of you being on the call today. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and 25 other organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call. We have on the call today over 512 participants. You come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas, and from rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, India, Sweden, and Syria. So you really come from all over the world, a group of information seekers. I would like to turn your attention to the materials that you receive from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about some upcoming programs that we offer, as well as information about all of the different organizations that can be resources for you as well. Now, there also is an evaluation form in your materials, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program to complete that evaluation form. Who but each of you can best tell us what we should be doing, what programs we should offer, what topics? So we very much rely on your feedback about the programs because you are in the best position to tell us really what you need. And so please do take a moment at the end of today's program and complete those evaluation forms. It will really help us as we move forward in planning all of the programs in the coming year. Now, today's program is made possible by a grant from the Avon Foundation, and I really want to thank them for supporting today's program. Now, we have really wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Julie Grelo. Dr. Grelo is Associate Professor, Medical Oncology, the University of Washington School of Medicine, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, Associate Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, Oncology Specialist. As you can see, Dr. Grelo wears many hats. She has spoken on our programs before. We're delighted to have her back. And she is going to cover the current standard of care and new treatment approaches, critical issues to consider when making treatment decisions, and quality of life concerns. Dr. Grelo.
Hi, Carolyn, and thanks for the opportunity of talking today. I've been asked to give a brief overview of the current standard of care in treating breast cancer and new treatment approaches. And in 2008, we are generally using a few main features of the tumor in order to decide which therapies are likely to work best. And the estrogen receptor and the HER2 gene and protein are the two most important right now in terms of making treatment decisions and deciding what drugs will work. So we will look at all tumors for the estrogen and progesterone receptor and HER2 and use these in factoring treatments. Now, where we're moving in the next few years, and we already have one toe in the door, kind of, is that we're going to be individualizing tumors even more, far beyond just the hormone receptors and HER2. And we do have one commonly used assay in a select subgroup of early-stage breast cancer where we're looking at 21 genes. So we have a 21-gene recurrence score assay that we call Oncotype DX, and we're using this to scan a tumor at the time of diagnosis for 21 different genes. And this is helpful in predicting recurrence and predicting benefit from chemotherapy. So the whole purpose behind looking at more genes is to try to decide who doesn't need chemotherapy, which is key. We know we're giving chemotherapy to a lot of patients who don't benefit from it, either because they're already cured and don't need it, or in some cases because their tumor is resistant to chemotherapy and we should focus on other kinds of treatments. Now, our treatment in 2008 is still divided into three main subtypes for breast cancer: endocrine or hormonal therapy, and this is all directed at the estrogen receptor. And so these treatments will only work in tumors that express estrogen and progesterone receptor. A big feature of where the research is right now in young women specifically, in premenopausal women, is whether in addition to the standard anti-estrogen treatment, tamoxifen, there is benefit from suppressing the ovaries in treating early stage and advanced stage breast cancer. And we have some large ongoing trials trying to assess this. Now, chemotherapy, in terms of the drugs we use, doesn't really vary between young women and older women, but one of the main side effects of chemotherapy, the effect on the ovaries in early menopause, which can sometimes be temporary, sometimes be permanent, this is something that obviously only happens in the young population. So this is key to our discussion today. Some chemotherapy regimens have a bit higher rate of causing chemotherapy-induced menopause. The younger you are at the time that you and your ovaries are exposed to chemotherapy, the less likely you are that the ovarian effects will be permanent. But this obviously is going to have major impacts on fertility, which Dr. Akhtay is going to discuss next. Now, the third class after endocrine or hormonal treatments and chemotherapy of treatments is biologically targeted therapy, and this is where a lot of excitement is. We already have two drugs that target HER2. This is only effective in about the 20 to 25% of breast cancers that express HER2, but in that group, these are very effective therapies with a proven role. We have just in 2008 a newly approved class of biologically targeted therapy. We call them angiogenesis inhibitors. They're blood vessel blockers. The tumor needs to bring in blood vessels to bring nutrients and oxygen in order for it to grow. And so this class of drugs blocks that. Avastin is the drug approved earlier this year in more advanced stage breast cancer. And it showed benefit when added to chemotherapy, and we're now testing it in early stage breast cancer. I can't even begin to tell you how many dozens of other classes of biologics are out there with a variety of different targets, and it's really a very exciting time. Now, I'm going to spend a minute or two here to focus on one important trial that was specific to young women that was presented just this June at our annual American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, because I think this talks about an exciting new area of treatment. There was a study that we call the ABCSG12 study. It stands for the Austrian Breast Cancer Study Group, study number 12. And this was restricted to premenopausal women that had tumors that expressed the estrogen receptor. And there were two questions asked in this study. They suppressed the ovaries for 3 years in all women in the study as a baseline and did two different randomizations, asked two different questions. One was, if we shut down the ovaries in premenopausal women, is tamoxifen still the best drug, or can we add an aromatase inhibitor instead, which only would work if you suppressed the ovaries, and would that be better? And the answer to that question was, in a premenopausal woman, if you suppress her ovaries, the aromatase inhibitor had no advantage. So this is important. Tamoxifen is still the standard in premenopausal women. Now, the second question is where there's some excitement. In the study, they also asked a second question. They added a drug that's a potent version of an osteoporosis drug called zoledronic acid, or Zometa. They added it just two doses a year by vein for 3 years in the study. What we saw previously was that it helped protect the bones when the ovaries were shut down. It maintained bone density, which is important in young women. But what we saw presented in June, which was very exciting, was that this drug additionally reduced recurrences when it was added just a total of six doses over 3 years. And there are very minor side effects. This really is just a potent osteoporosis drug. So we're trying to sort out whether other studies will show the same thing, whether it only works in young women with estrogen receptor positive tumors, or if it would benefit many more women. And the whole hypothesis behind why this works is because breast cancer tends to like to track to bone. Bone is an environment that can nurture it. And so if we disrupt that environment by preventing bone breakdown, which the cancer tries to do when it ends up there, then maybe we can make this a less desirable environment for the cancer cell to land in, and we can prevent any bone recurrences at all in the future. So a very exciting area of research. Now, I'll just end by addressing critical issues when making treatment decisions. I've reviewed that we need to know certain features, the estrogen receptor, the HER2 receptor, and we need to think about three different categories of drugs, endocrine, chemotherapy, biologics. And the whole issue here is we have to understand the toxicities and risks of each therapy and carefully weigh it against the benefit that we would expect in a given patient and a given cancer. Now, of course, today our theme is really that one of the long-term consequences of chemotherapy is ovarian dysfunction. And we have to assess based on a patient's age and her health and the chemotherapy regimen given how likely is it to cause permanent ovarian function problems. And weigh that against what's the benefit, what reduction in recurrence would we expect when we're giving it. If it's only a few percent reduction in recurrence, then I'd say that the long-term consequences of a premature menopause and all of the other issues that go with chemo wouldn't be worth it. Even if there is a small predicted benefit, the side effects and the risk would outweigh that. And so we have to think about that. We have all the consequences of menopause on the bone, on the urogenital and the vaginal tissue, on our heart and our cholesterol, on our skin, and the quality of life, the hot flashes, the mood swings, the sleep disturbances. You know, for chemo in general, even if we don't induce menopause, fatigue is one of the biggest concerns, and that's something that women fight during the treatment and then work to for years afterwards to regain their energy level. So we always need to talk about not just kind of the serious and short-term consequences, but the long-term consequences of any drug when we're making treatment decisions. All drugs have side effects. Of course, I'm a big proponent of always making sure that in addition to whatever drug therapy we give, that we focus on the other healthy things that we can do that can make us feel better during treatment, feel stronger, recover faster, and in some cases even potentially reduce recurrences. And those would include nutrition, physical activity, maintaining a good body weight, and all of those things that can impact both our quality of life and, in some cases, even our recurrence rates. And so with that summary with a lot of data, I think I'll turn it back to Carolyn, and we're happy to take questions at the end.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Grelo, for just really doing an outstanding presentation and really setting the context for the call today and really identifying all the issues that our callers need to consider on this call in terms of issues to consider in terms of treatment. Our next speaker is Dr. Cutluck Oktay, and Dr. Oktay is Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He's Director, Division of Reproductive Medicine and Infertility, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Westchester Medical Center, New York Medical College, and he's also Medical Director, Institute for Fertility Preservation, Center for Human Reproduction, and a consultant for Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Oktay is going to, and you can see he has many titles, and he actually wears many hats as well, and he's going to address fertility-related considerations. Dr. Oktay.
Oh, thank you very much for this introduction, and I also thank for the the first speaker for paving the way for what I'm going to talk about now. There's no question that the benefit of chemotherapy in radiotherapy to cancer patients in terms of the treatment of their disease. However, there are associated side effects with that, one of which is the impact on fertility, and that is not only for women or females and also for men and boys. And according to one estimate, potentially 1% of the entire U.S. population may be subjected to some form of chemo treatment that can potentially affect fertility. And as mentioned, cancer treatments not always damage fertility. There are certain drugs that are more damaging than the others, and most of them are known as alkylating agents, and they happen to be in most chemotherapy regimens. On the other hand, there are many new agents that are being added in different classes of agents that we have less information on, and current research is going on to determine more objectively what the damage from these drugs are. One of the problems with assessing the damaging effects of cancer treatments on fertility, especially in women, is that we rely on menstruation. Most studies looked at what happened to menstruation after the treatment, and those studies assumed that fertility was normal if menstruation returned. And we clearly know, as infertility specialists, that having menstruation does not equal to normal fertility. As a matter of fact, if you look at healthy women, even though they may continue to menstruate till the age of 51, fertility is severely diminished after 40, and for most women, it is completely gone after the age of 45. So in most cases, women, especially if they're very young, they may receive chemotherapy. And what chemotherapy does is that take away a big chunk of the egg reserve. Especially women are born with a set number of eggs. So if a chemotherapy agent takes away half of that reserve, the remaining half may continue to function, but it would function for much shorter time, and therefore the fertile period would be reduced. And if you only looked at whether that person is menstruating or not after chemotherapy, we may be mistaken, and our and others' research have also shown that. So I think that's an important point to pay attention to. And I appreciate the fact that most patients on the call probably have had their treatments. And however, it's important to mention some of the fertility preservation strategies. There are many things that can be done to preserve fertility, and that depends on the patient's individual circumstances. In men, if this is a postpubertal boy or an adult, there is semen cryopreservation, in other words, freezing semen. Even with one sample of semen, a lot can be done because of the advent of technologies like injecting a single sperm into an egg, and therefore that could be enough for many attempts at in vitro fertilization. Unfortunately, in prepubertal boys, the only option is a very experimental option, that is testicular or freezing testicular tissue, but there's progress being made. Now, coming to the female side, it is a little bit more complicated because it involves being giving considerations to menstrual period and the timing. And fertility treatments, the more established methods, take at least 2 weeks, for example, embryo or egg freezing. Therefore, if you're dealing with an adult person and there is at least 2 weeks or so available, then we would consider freezing embryos or, if this person is single, eggs from this patient. When there is not enough time, there's a more experimental procedure called ovarian tissue cryopreservation. That is, one ovary or a portion of an ovary can be removed without the need for fertility treatments with an outpatient surgery, and that tissue can be frozen for future transplantation. This is an experimental procedure, and the first transplants were done by our team approximately 10 years ago, and since then there have been 30 or so transplants and about 4 or 5 babies. Therefore, in general, the approach is to offer more established techniques such as embryo and egg freezing. And if there's no time, or if you're dealing with children where you cannot do ovarian stimulation, to offer ovarian stimulation. I'm sorry, ovarian cryopreservation or ovarian freezing for future transplantation. When we are dealing with women with estrogen-sensitive cancer, and that is specifically breast cancer because that's the most common cancer in reproductive age women, they tend to have sufficient time to undergo more established fertility preservation procedures such as embryo and egg freezing because usually they have weeks between surgery and chemotherapy. But the problem there is that there is a concern that because fertility drugs would increase estrogen levels, that might have adverse impact on the treatment success. For those patients, our group also developed a way of doing fertility treatments without significantly increasing estrogen levels. Specifically, as was mentioned in the previous talk, aromatase inhibitors, when used in premenopausal women, work like fertility drugs. So when you combine these with standard fertility drugs, you can keep estrogen levels low even when many eggs are developing in response to fertility drugs. And we have studied this now for up to 8 years, and our recent 5-year follow-up was published in Journal of Clinical Oncology, where we did not find any adverse effect on the effectiveness of cancer treatments when women underwent this procedure to freeze their eggs or embryos. Another controversial area is that whether we can protect ovaries by putting the ovaries to sleep with drugs called GnRH analogs. These are kind of medications. They put a woman into a menopause-like situation temporarily. However, a recent randomized study at the current ASCO meeting suggested that this approach is not beneficial to protect ovaries. Therefore, most currently, its benefit is not proven. And in terms of after chemotherapy, there are several issues that can come up. One is, how safe is it to get pregnant, especially for a woman with breast cancer? There are over 20 studies that looked at this, and none found any adverse effect of pregnancy on women who had previous cancer when they had children. And none of these studies are perfect or can be perfect because you cannot design studies where you have to voluntarily ask women to get or not to get pregnant. Therefore, there are weaknesses in the studies, but nevertheless, studies either did not show any increase in risk or even show the survival benefit if they conceived, went on to conceive. And one other issue with women with breast cancer, what if I had a tram flap done for breast reconstruction because the abdominal muscles are used for that? And even though there aren't much data out there or published studies, by limited observations, this does not seem to pose a big problem. And finally, how to assess how much fertility is left after chemotherapy. That is also a challenging issue. Current tests, such as using follicle-stimulating hormone or estradiol measurements, are not very reliable, and they do not tell you how much fertility is left. They usually tell you when there is no fertility left. But currently, there is a test called anti-Müllerian hormone, which is promising to be that kind of marker, and studies are continuing along these lines. So I'll be happy to answer any questions related to that during the question and answer session. Again, thank you for having me on the panel.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Akhtay, for a very comprehensive presentation on this subject. I appreciate that. I know there'll be questions during the Q&A for you. Our next speaker is Deborah Wolf. Deborah is an attorney, and she's a senior attorney with Legal Health, New York Legal Assistance Group, NILAC. And she is going to cover Cancer and Careers legal protections. Deborah?
Thank you, Carolyn. So while employed, there are a number of laws that offer protection and allow a person to continue working after their diagnosis and during treatment, or protect them if they need additional time off from work. And I'm going to focus on federal laws that apply to all 50 states, but I encourage all listeners to find out about their state laws as well, and I'll talk about that as well in a few minutes. I first want to talk about the Family Medical Leave Act, also known as FMLA. And FMLA applies to all employers with 50 or more employees. The employee must have worked for 12 months and have worked for 1,250 months over the prior 12 months. And if qualified, FMLA offers an employee 12 weeks of job-protected leave. During those 12 weeks, their benefits must continue, although the employee must pay for their portion of the benefits, but it guarantees a return to work at an employee's job or a similar job at the same pay. What's important to know about FMLA that I think a lot of people are not aware of is that it also can be used for what's known as intermittent leave, for doctor visits, regularly scheduled treatments. So this is useful if a person has used up all of the sick time that's available to them, and again, it offers job protection. So if somebody has a treatment every other Thursday afternoon and needs to take off every other Thursday for this reason, they can apply for intermittent FMLA leave, and they don't have to worry that there's going to be any adverse consequences from their employer because they're taking this additional time off. Employees usually request FMLA leave through their human resources, and it does require a medical certification signed by their physician that they do have a serious illness. And it's also available to family members who may need to care for a spouse or a parent. And FMLA is not paid leave, but an employee can supplement that with any available sick time that they have, vacation time, and also short-term disability if available, and I'll talk about that in a minute as well. I also want to talk about the Americans with Disabilities Act, which applies to all employers with at least 15 employees. And it covers all qualified disabilities, and cancer will be a qualified disability if it limits a major life activity such as walking, working, eating, reproduction. If so, then it is a covered disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the ADA has two benefits. The first is that an employer must give an employee a reasonable accommodation. And an employee can go to their boss and say, you know what, I can do this job, but for medical reasons, I need you to accommodate me in this manner or in this way. Some examples might be a physical change in the workspace. I recently set up an accommodation for one of my clients with MS so that she was a teacher, so that her classroom was, she was assigned a classroom next to the restroom to make it easier for her and also on the first floor. Perhaps a shorter work day or a later start in the morning if there's side effects from medications or treatment that are causing nausea. More frequent breaks for snacks to decrease nausea. Working at home one day a week, again, depending on what somebody's position is and whether or not they'll be able to perform their job or the duties of their position from home. The most important thing is that with a reasonable accommodation, an employee must still be able to perform the essential duties of their position. So, for example, if somebody's a store clerk, working at home may not be an option for them, but perhaps if they're a graphic artist or work with a computer, working at home could be an option for one day a week. And what I always suggest to people I speak with is to think of ways that your employer can assist you in continuing working. And an employer cannot say no to an accommodation request. What they can say is, you know what, this might not work for us for this reason, but let's talk about what's going to work for both of us. So there can be a process of negotiation, you know, to set up an accommodation that's reasonable. But But employer simply can't refuse and say, we're not going to do that. I always suggest that a person apply for an accommodation in writing with a supporting letter from their doctor that states that the employee, their patient, can perform the essential functions of their job and that the accommodation is medically necessary. And that letter must contain a diagnosis so that the employer can see that their employee has a qualified disability. Under the Americans with Disability Act, medical information that's provided to an employer is confidential. So if in a request for an accommodation is accompanied by a doctor's letter, human resources can't disclose the nature of their illness or the reason for the accommodation. They certainly would have to say to a supervisor that this person, we've set up an accommodation for this person and here's what the accommodation is, but they're not allowed to give any confidential medical information to anybody else in the workplace. And disclosure in the workplace is an important consideration, and I think for any person with any medical issue, the determination as to, you know, who they want to disclose to should be their choice entirely. So generally, unless applying for FMLA leave or for an ADA accommodation, there's really no requirement to disclose in the workplace. And again, if disclosure is done through human resources with a medical letter, then human resources is required to maintain confidentiality. This is one area where I want to stress that it's also important to understand your state laws. For example, in New York, we have a state law that's very similar to the Americans with Disabilities Act, but applies to employers with four or more employees. So it's offered to a broader range of people and also has a broader definition of what a qualified or a covered disability is. The second benefit of the ADA is that it prohibits discrimination in the workplace. So if a person feels that they're being treated unfairly after making a disclosure, they're protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and any type of discrimination is prohibited. I always suggest that if somebody believes that they are being discriminated against, that they first go to Human Resources and speak with them, because it's really HR's role to educate employees and supervisors who may not understand these laws that do protect people. And then if there's no resolution, then there's options available, including filing a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, who will investigate and issue a determination of cause. In fact, if somebody's considering a lawsuit for discrimination or for failure to accommodate under the Americans with Disabilities Act, filing a complaint with the EEOC is a prerequisite. It's required prior to actually filing a lawsuit. And again, if anybody has any concerns, I also strongly suggest that they consult with an attorney, because time limits are strict and in some of these cases can be complicated. I want to take just another minute to talk a little bit about employee benefits. All employers must offer what's known as a summary plan description, which is a summary of benefits that explains the type of coverage that you have. Health insurance, disability coverage, as well as the type of plan that you have, whether or not your health insurance is an HMO or a point of service. And it sets forth all the exclusions and provides for maximums in coverage. And I think it's information that people need to know in planning to ensure that all costs are covered. And sometimes it's uncomfortable to think of a way to ask for information about benefits, but it's very reasonable for any employee to say to Human Resources or to a supervisor, you know, I want to understand all my benefits. Is there a copy of the summary plan description that's available? Employers are supposed to furnish these to employees, but that doesn't always happen. And then if somebody needs to take a leave from work for treatment or health reasons, it's always important to understand what benefits are available for income continuation. One is short-term disability, and five states have mandatory short-term disability, which requires an employer to pay for the first 26 weeks that somebody is out of work, and it's not full salary but a percentage of income. And other employers have private short-term disability, which will pay for a percentage of income. And this is information that would be contained on your summary plan description. And then also, if a longer leave is required, you know, look into whether or not your employer provides for any type of long-term disability, as well as the option of Social Security disability. And then finally, if somebody's on leave, and even after they've exhausted their family medical leave and have no more time left to for job-protected leave, they still will be able to maintain their health insurance coverage under COBRA, which applies to employers with 20 or more employees. And again, check New York, or check your state law, because in New York we have a COBRA law that applies to two or more employers. Two or more employees. And it allows somebody to keep their health insurance for 18 months, and that can be extended to 29 months under certain circumstances as well. So I know this was a lot of information in a concise time, so I will be available for questions as well.
Well, I want to thank you, Deborah, for really just, again, very comprehensive, outstanding review of a lot of the issues that I know many of our members of the audience are very interested to know more about. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you very much. Excellent. And our next speaker is Patricia Spicer. Pat is an oncology social worker, and she's our breast cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Pat is going to address some of the issues around communicating your choices with your healthcare team and give you a bit of a review of Cancer Care services. Pat?
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. I think one of the most important things as I listened to the presentation today was the thought that so much of the information that was provided is things that women are sometimes reluctant to talk to their doctors about, particularly in terms of fertility or the restoration of sexuality and libido after chemotherapy. So I'd like to talk to you today a little bit about how you may be able to develop a better communications with your doctor that will help you to understand what your treatment is about, or if you're finished with treatment, those remaining questions that are sometimes become issues as you continue to move back into your regular life. One of the important things you can use when talking to a doctor is to use I statements. For example, the phrase, "I don't understand," is much more effective than you're being unclear about. The I statement makes it clear that you were the one who needs the information and that it's not the doctor's fault that they're not able to communicate it, but that you need a better understanding. Don't be afraid about being assertive either. If you feel you're not getting a proper answer, or you don't know what a word means, or they are speaking med speak, which sometimes we forget in the healthcare profession and do, make sure that you ask your doctor to slow down, to repeat the word, or to explain it in lay language, because it's important that you understand what your treatment options are and how they will affect your benefit-risk ratio. If something seems confusing, try repeating it back to your doctor. Say something like, "It seems to me that what you said is," or "You mean I should," and then see if you can get a response from your doctor that makes it clear for you. If you have trouble remembering all of it, and lots of people do just because they're sometimes nervous or anxious when they're at the doctor's, take someone with you, or write out a list of questions that the doctor can answer at his or her convenience. Some doctors will let you use a tape recorder, and that's a great way, but don't walk into the office and plonk it on the desk. It's a good idea to check with the doctor's office first to see if he or she is comfortable being taped, but it's a good way to be able to play back with someone exactly what the dialogue was about. The most important thing to remember is you are a consumer of your own health care. And if you have questions or concerns and you don't feel that you're getting proper answers, move on. Most doctors understand if you can't form a relationship with them or if you just feel that their communication skills are not what you need, don't be afraid to suggest that, to say thank you and to suggest that you are going to switch your health care. Remember, this is your body, it's your future, and you want to make sure you're taking good care of yourself and getting what it is you need to make your quality of life the best it can be. At Cancer Care, we would like to be of help to you with any questions or concerns you might have, whether you're on treatment or whether you've finished with treatment or in a survivorship mode. You can contact us directly by calling 1-800-813-4673 or going to our website at www.cancercare.org. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, for actually identifying some of the issues in terms of just communicating with your healthcare team and also in terms of reviewing the service of cancer care. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have lots of time for questions. So I'm going to ask Janitha to bring all of our speakers on board and also to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin. Janitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered, or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Andy. Go ahead, please.
Yes. just for the panel, I was just wondering if you could tell me which five states have the short-term disability laws in place.
Deborah. I can certainly do that. I don't have it right in front of me, but I can start by saying New York, Hawaii, and give me 1 second and I will pull up the rest. It is California, New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Hawaii are the five states that have mandatory short-term disability.
Well, thank you very much. That's a great question. And Deborah, thank you for that great answer. Thank you. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Shirley. Go ahead, please.
Yes, this would be for Deborah, and this has been a continuing concern with me. I know there is a federal law that covers compression sleeves for following breast cancer surgery, but when you bring it up to Medicare, it's like they've never heard of the law. They don't know what you're talking about. And I have had, but they said, well, they would consider a claim, and I have had a claim in since May, and it still has not been paid. And why is there such confusion and no clarity on this when it's a federal law?
Well, I actually, before anyone answers, I just want to say that we do have a program tomorrow on Medicare, actually a teleconference. But actually, if you'd like to address that, Deborah.
So are you speaking about a claim in with Medicare to cover the cost of a treatment?
Of a lymphedema.
To cover the cost of compression sleeves as a result of lymphedema, which is a result of breast cancer surgery.
Mm-hmm. And Medicare has refused to cover it at this point?
I'm not saying that they are refusing to. It's like they have never heard of the federal law, and they say, well, submit the claim, and I did that in May, and it's December, and it still has not been paid.
Can I add to that, Carolyn?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Up until recently, Medicare has not been paying for lymphedema's compression garments. But I would like to add that Cancer Care, through the Komen Foundation, does have a program that can help with the cost of paying for a garment. So if you'd like to go to our website or call the 1-800 number, perhaps we can be of help to you. And processing any Medicare claim can be endless.
That was actually going to be my response as well, that unfortunately sometimes Medicare takes more time than they should, but, you know, by all means, if you haven't requested assistance, you know, there's every state has organizations that will assist with Medicare claims. And there's also an organization called the Medicare Right Center who are on the Internet who have wonderful information about ways that you can try and motivate Medicare to pay their claims and move a little quicker?
Well, excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Shelley, for that excellent question. I know that's a question that's come up before. I appreciate you asking the question. I think please do turn to the staff at Cancer Care to assist you with that. Anybody else on the call who has similar problems or concerns, just really call our staff. They can really help you to get help with that. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Jennifer. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question about for the doctor about what are the chances that breast cancer can return with the IVF or fertility medications to try to get pregnant after breast cancer?
Okay, so I'm going to ask Dr. Akhtar if you can address that in a general way.
Yes. Can we clarify the question? What are the chances the cancer can – I couldn't hear the
– with the use of estrogen and progesterone and all the other types of IVF fertility medication.
Yes.
Are there any studies?
Yeah, what is the risk that that is involved in doing that in women with breast cancer?
Yes.
Right? Correct?
Yes, yes.
First of all – it is impossible, nearly impossible, to do a study where you would subject a woman with breast cancer to standard fertility drugs or high estrogen levels because, especially if they have an estrogen-sensitive cancer, you know, we know that this could potentially be harmful. So it's impossible to design a study where you would knowingly be putting patients at least, you know, theoretical risk. However, you know, based on everything we know about breast cancer, especially receptor positive cancer, that they're driven by estrogen. On the other hand, considering this fact, we have developed ways to perform IVF, in vitro fertilization treatments, with the drug called letrozole, an aromatase inhibitor, and this same drug is used for hormonal treatment of postmenopausal breast cancer. But the drug, when used in premenopausal women, works as a fertility drug. At the same time, it lowers estrogen levels. So we published three or four papers on this in terms of how safely and effectively this can be used for in vitro fertilization treatments. So far, our studies show that in women with breast cancer, when you use the drug letrozole along with fertility drugs, you can keep estrogen levels much lower. You can obtain as many eggs and embryos as you would get from standard protocols. Your pregnancy rates would be similar. And at five-year follow-up, the course of breast cancer is not affected.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Jennifer. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Yes, I am 36 years old and just finished treatment for breast cancer, and I'm unable to take tamoxifen. I'm hormone positive, so they put me on Lupron and Arimidex. And I was fortunate enough to retrieve one embryo and cryopreserve it prior to chemotherapy, but I'm now just wondering and concerned if Lupron isn't aiding and protecting my ovaries, then why am I told to take it? What's the point?
Dr. Grelo, could you address that?
Well, I'm not sure why you were unable to take tamoxifen, but a combination of suppressing the ovaries and adding an aromatase inhibitor is likely equal to tamoxifen based on some recent studies. So the aromatase inhibitor all by itself would just not work in a premenopausal setting. It only works to suppress what essentially is adrenal-driven estrogen production. It won't suppress the ovary. So you need that ovarian suppression in order to be able to take the aromatase inhibitor. Now, if your tumor is estrogen receptor positive, the ovarian suppression may additionally add on top of the aromatase inhibitor or the tamoxifen as well. And it certainly, we don't think that temporary suppression would inhibit your ability for future fertility. I think that's what you were worried about. It certainly won't increase your chance of a recurrence, and it shouldn't, because it should be reversible, should not impact your future ovarian function.
Carol, may I comment here? Because I think
I created
a confusion here. I think that's why, because I mentioned that using GnRH analogs things like Lupron or Zoladex does not protect fertility during chemotherapy. And so in this setting, we're talking about somebody who had chemotherapy and will be put on Arimidex, and to prevent Arimidex from stimulating her ovaries, then they give Lupron to shut down the hormones. So in that setting, post-chemotherapy, it wouldn't be relevant anyway. And the second point is that in reality, aromatase inhibitors, especially letrozole, does work on ovaries, and it does shut down ovaries, but it would take weeks before it shuts it down. And therefore, before it shuts it, it would stimulate it. And that's why initial studies concluded that it's not good for premenopausal women for the purpose of treating breast cancer. And it never shuts down completely. But when you use it along with fertility drugs, you actually see that you can shut it down by about 80%. So that means you lower estrogen levels by 80%. But what really cancer doctors want is they want 100% suppression, which it doesn't do in premenopausal women.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Leanne. Go ahead, please.
Okay, hi. I believe this question is more for Dr. Akhtay and Dr. Graylo. I was put on tamoxifen in July. Prior to that, my husband and I went through an IVF cycle, and we froze about, 16, 18 embryos. My question is, my oncologist basically not recommends. She said if I want to do, I could get off tamoxifen for 2 years. After I take it for 2 years, get off and try to get pregnant, then get back on it. And my question is, why 2 years? Why not 1 year?
Thank you for that excellent question. Dr. Graylo, could you start by addressing it?
Well, I think this is where we get into how we prioritize things in our life and what's important. Clearly, fertility and having a child seems to be a very high priority for you. And so what we're doing is we're balancing priorities, making some compromises. What we know about tamoxifen is in trials over the past couple of decades that 1 year of treatment is better than none. 2 years is better than 1 year. 5 years is better than 2 years. And for the most part, especially in early stage breast cancer, 10 years is no better than 5 and actually causes more side effects. So that's how we settled on the 5 years. Now, I think what's happening here is that, you know, you and your healthcare team are making some compromises. Fertility is a big driver, but also your healthcare team wants to make sure that you're minimizing your risk of recurrence so that you'll be around to raise your child as well. And so, although ideally we'd prefer 5 years, it's a chance that you'd be able to carry through a full-term pregnancy even with these embryos goes down with each year that you age. So knowing that if you complete a full 5 years, you'll be less able to carry through a pregnancy. And so that's where the compromise is going on. 2 years is better than one, but one is better than none. And there's no good data that says exactly when you might be able to interrupt that. And some of it will depend on features of your cancer that you should go over with your healthcare team, where the lymph nodes positive was at high grade, and other features that would predict recurrence and benefit from the tamoxifen. And additionally, you can go back on the tamoxifen again at some point in the future. We don't know how much that will help the cancer you've already had, but it certainly could act as a chemo preventive agent to continue to lower your risk of a second breast cancer even many years later.
Dr. Akhtay, did you want to add anything?
Sure, yes. Part of the confusion, again, comes from the general belief that pregnancy is safer if you waited for 2 years after the diagnosis of breast cancer, which is not based on any data. As a matter of fact, if you look at those 20-some studies, some of them even looked at conceiving as early as 6 months after completion of treatment and did not find any difference on the disease. So in terms of when is it safe after breast cancer, if you just leave all these issues alone, tamoxifen treatment, let's say you're estrogen receptor negative, really data doesn't show that, do not show that it's not safe to get pregnant even as early as 6 months. So I think when making recommendations, this also affects why they suggested her that she should be at least on tamoxifen for 2 years. Having said that, we have had similar situations where we were able to negotiate with the oncologist either a lull for from tamoxifen treatment after 2 years, after 1 year. In some cases, even with DCIS cases, even deferring tamoxifen beyond pregnancy. But none of these are studied in long term. And the other issue here is sometimes there may be another compromise. Because you already had chemotherapy and your fertility is diminished, you may still have some fertility remaining. But if you were to wait another 2 to 5 years to complete tamoxifen, by that time, whatever eggs are left may be gone. So in some patients, we would negotiate a 2-3 months break, and during that time, we may do a few cycles to freeze more eggs and embryos. So that may be another way out of this. And there's a third way of negotiating this. You may actually, if legal in your state, you may use a surrogate. So you take this 2-3 months break, you get stimulated, and those embryos are transferred to a surrogate so that you can start your tamoxifen. So there are many options, depending on your situation, and you don't necessarily have to be exposed to those risks.
So it's very important for the question, and which makes everybody think about the answer and how they should best apply it to themselves, but to actually for each person to think through with their healthcare team. And really, these are difficult decisions to make. I actually wanted to ask Dr. Grelo a question in terms of the way treatments are being delivered now to young women. And is there a change from over the years now in terms of how treatments are delivered? And you were kind of implying that you're trying to consider many different factors here.
Right, and I think we're getting more individualized with respect to both the tumor and the patient. I do think that we're giving less chemotherapy. We're feeling more comfortable that we can identify a group who will maximally benefit from endocrine therapy or who doesn't need therapy at all. Those are trends that are going on, and as all of these new biologic therapies that are in development come into play and are better tested, I think we'll be giving a lot less chemo, which is really the class of drugs that wreaks the most havoc on menopause and fertility issues in young women.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My question is for Deborah. Can you point me to a quick resource perhaps on the internet where I could print out like a fact sheet that's easily understood by patients regarding FMLA and how they can begin discussions with their employers about this?
Absolutely. Actually, the Department of Labor has a wonderful website about the FMLA. If you actually do a search for FMLA, it should be the first site that comes up, and it very clearly, it has fact sheets about, who's covered, what's covered, what employers are covered, what employees need to do, very, very user-friendly website. And again, because it's a federal law, the law is the same in all 50 states.
We also, I just wanted to say that Cancer Care has, on its homepage, actually has something called Ask Cancer Care, and we have a section on cancer in the workplace. And in that section, all those links are there for you so that you could actually access that through that site as well.
There's also a wonderful site, if I could add, called the Job Accommodation Network. It's, again, if you do a search, you'll find it, and it has wonderful information about applying all of these laws in the workplace, FMLA, the ADA. It has sample job accommodation, reasonable accommodation requests, and also a very useful website for people that are trying to set up a reasonable accommodation or understand their rights under the FMLA.
Excellent. Our next question.
Our next question is from Diana. Go ahead, please.
Yes. My question is about short-term disability insurance. Are there any laws or restrictions about getting it privately, not from an employer? I do not have it through my employer. I have a federal job, and I was told that, you know, job does not provide it. I tried to purchase it after my treatment finished it, and one of the insurance agents told me you have to wait 5 years after the diagnosis.
There are private short-term disabilities policies available. I think you're correct in that most of them do have what they call a pre-existing condition exclusion, which will exclude coverage for any pre-existing condition. But again, this is an area where you should check your state law, because different states do have laws with respect to, well, for example, New York has a law that says a person who's been diagnosed with cancer cannot be turned down for life insurance or disability insurance after a certain amount of time. But there
the
are definitely
State Insurance Commission would actually be a wonderful resource.
Also another good resource, Carolyn. It's a website. It's called www.cancerlegalresource.org. And they are based in California, but they will give you information on their website or over the phone regarding your state.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And I also would encourage you to, clearly, any of these questions that we've answered, please feel free to call our staff at Cancer Care as well. I want to actually thank our speakers who have really just been wonderful. I have to say, wonderful panel of speakers today. I want to give them all a round of applause. They've been wonderful. I want to thank all of you who have asked really such thoughtful questions, which really allowed all of our speakers to address your various concerns. And I want to thank all of you who also have been listening on the call today. Now, we, in planning a program like this is a one-hour education program, and that we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So I, again, want to just review with you all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Now, Cancer Care has a staff of 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling to information about resources, how to get things, where to turn for information. We also offer a number of different groups, both on the telephone and online. And we have a lot of different materials and booklets, and of course we have a number of telephone workshops, and those are archived as podcasts, so you can go to our website and listen to programs that we've done in the past on topics like cancer in the workplace, on issues around, we have a program tomorrow on issues that may affect many of you in terms of Medicare issues that someone raised on the call. So we have lots of different topics that we offer, and you can visit our websites for that information. But most importantly, as we conclude our call today, I wouldn't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with breast cancer. I'd like you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that you can contact us at any time. 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff are here to take your questions and help you and guide you along the way. So that please, I know this is also a difficult time of year around the holidays. We do have a program coming up on coping with the holidays for caregivers, but I recognize that this is a particularly challenging time, and I want you to know that we are here to help you, and we don't want you to feel like you're alone. So please give us a call, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.